I'm going to talk about the work that we did with NFS stuff. One of my colleagues suggested the name, it should have been Industrial Strength NFS Tracing. So, we wanted to collect customer NFS traces, and the customer will remain anonymous because that was part of the deal that allowed us to publish all of the traces. We went in, we took the techniques that were present in the existing literature, we applied them, and it pretty much fell over before we really even got a chance to get going. So what I'm hoping to do in this talk is I'm going to explain to you how we managed to take all of the existing work and convert it so that we could work with much more intense traces. You will see through the talk that this lends to a whole bunch of incremental improvements. You actually need most of them. If you do any subset of them, you pretty much don't end up with something that will solve the problem. There are a lot more details in the paper. But there are really two things to take out of this talk. First thing is, if you're going to take traces, read the paper, apply it. I really wish this paper had existed before we did it because we made a bunch of mistakes along the way. The second thing is for people that want to look at workloads, they want to do trace replay, they want to do analysis, take a look at our workload. It's very different from what we've seen in previous papers, and we have only begun to look at the data that's in there. But we'll back up, because some people may not really understand why do we take traces. And there are two big reasons to do this. First is you want to understand what does the real world look like, because we are designing new systems. So you might want to look at how many operations are there to give you an idea of how cold things are and how fast your system has to be able to run. How big are the files? You know, can I put it all on flash, or am I going to have to use gigantic tapes to store it? How cacheable are they? Because this tells you whether or not you're going to be able to put caches through the system. Are the accesses sequential? Are you going to be able to do useful prefetching, or does it turn out it's all random? And perhaps most important, what trends are present? What's it going to look like in 5 years when hopefully my research would start being applied to some other system? We also use this to evaluate new system designs. So once we have looked at all of our real workloads and we figured out a new possible idea, we want to go and run it through a simulator or an emulator to see whether or not the right thing happens. So let's play that game and see whether or not what we have already is good enough. So I'm a system designer. I want to see a trend in the workload, and I'm going to look at how many millions of operations do we have per day. And this is nice because it actually shows up in all of the papers calculated in exactly the same way. So we can see there's a nice exponential curve coming out here. I mean, there's a little outlier down there that we can ignore. So we got a nice exponential curve, so I can tell you that in 2010 it'll be somewhere up there. Now, some of you may have realized what I just told you was complete bunk. The two blue circles, those are actually NFS traces. They were taken at Harvard, actually by our session chair. And so that's one particular type of workload down there. 2008 traces, those are actually from NetApp work groups. That's actually SIFS traces. So now I've succeeded in comparing two completely different types of traces. These two traces are our traces. These were collected in an animation movie rendering house. So I've managed to compare three different types of data. And in fact, if you go and look at pretty much every single one of the papers, all of them say somewhere in there, we collected all of this data. We will now present to you a representative subset out of it. And occasionally, we don't even bother to claim it's representative. It's an interesting subset. So what does this tell you? First thing is from looking at exactly how much bigger our traces are, this is actually exactly why the existing techniques started falling over and they fell over so early. So we're going to need to develop some new tools to work with that. The second thing that you'll see from this is even on what you can consider the most trivial of possible metrics, we're already seeing a gigantic variation in the traces, and you see that in every single one of the papers. So what this tells us is as a community, we need to collect way, way, way more traces. We have undersampled this, and this is a 10-year timeline. If you go back, there are more traces that you can start running that are much earlier, but you know they're even less representative because they're now in excess of a decade old. So I said we're going to talk about two things. We'll start talking with the tools. To understand how the tools fit together, you have to understand the entire process for doing trace analysis. Your first step in this is you have to capture it. This means you're going to go into some environment. Usually this is your own. In our case, this was a customer environment. So we haul a whole bunch of equipment over to their site. We plug it into their stuff. We capture the stuff out. We get something in a raw form. And what raw form comes out depends on exactly how you capture it. Usually, that raw form is not actually particularly useful to try to work with. So we have to do some conversion. We're going to take the raw form. We're going to cook it. We're going to have something that you can actually look at. If we're good, we're going to have something that we can distribute to other people, which means we will have anonymized it along the way. But you still don't actually have what you want. So now you're going to take that cooked data, and you're going to run it through some analysis or some simulation. And this is going to give you some data out of it. And finally, you're going to run it through some graphing and reporting. And this is going to take the data, and it's going to turn it into information. And in the second half of the talk, I will present some of the information that we got. Just to reinforce it, the details are in the paper, and all of our tools and our traces are open source. In theory, anyone here with, well, technically, a big enough network connection to download the traces could completely reproduce the entire paper that we have. All of the graphs, all of the results, you can rerun the whole thing. Let's take a look at the customer, just so that you get a feel for it. It's very different than your traditional academic setup. They were a feature animation, which is to say a movie, the thing you go and watch in the theater company. You have a whole bunch of clients in your system. These clients are going to read in various files. Their files represent models, textures, animation curves, etc. While they're doing that, they're going to write out a bunch of intermediate things. So they might write out partial frames. They might do simulations in order to figure out where particles are going to go. And they'll cache the results of that. They'll also write out the actual pictures that make up the movie. It takes about 3 years from start to finish to make a movie, although most of the work is actually done in the last year on the compute farm. So, looking at our players in this, we have thousands of clients. That's that big pile of stuff up there. We have tens of NFS servers. So this is already getting fairly big, and these are current NFS servers when they do it. And we have, say, 20s of NFS caches. The customer found their workload was very cacheable and their NFS servers were falling behind, so they put those in. You have a whole bunch of rack switches. Remember, I've only drawn 6 clients here. That represents, you know, thousands. They all connect into core routers. And again, I only drew one, but there are many of them, and they are redundant. Clients can either go directly to an NFS server for particularly uncacheable data, or they can access it through the NFS cache if they want to go to cacheable data. So, roll your time back. It's 2003 when we were originally doing this. We're trying to figure out how to do capture. We started by looking at, okay, we have to do this non-intrusively. Our first attempt was actually to use the file server's ability to capture data, and we just discovered that completely distorted the workload. So, we looked around for other solutions. We discovered that port mirroring on the switch is about as non-intrusive as you can get for doing the data capture. The second challenge that we had is we actually wanted to be able to parse things like read dirs. Read dirs are really inconvenient. They actually span your entire packet. In fact, they can span multiple packets, which means that you can't do the traditional trick, which is I'm just going to capture headers, which makes your capture really fast. So we actually have to capture the entire packet. We want to be able to do offline conversion. The reason we wanted this was for paranoia. Anytime you go and do something on a customer site, you discover there are many weird things that you see on their network. We would prefer our converter to stop and tell us that something has gone weird rather than randomly make a decision and keep going. But that means that we needed to do offline conversion. Therefore, we have to capture this all out to a parallel set of disks. The next challenge we ran into, which was really a combination of these three, is we now have NFS traffic bursts above a gigabit a second. Today, not nearly as much of a difficulty. Back then, much more of one. We ended up taking an open source tool that used a special interface inside of Linux to much more efficiently capture the data out. The last problem that we had, we'd really like to have long capture. We actually had about 50 drives that we were using to capture this. This would give us, if we had been naive, on the order of 2 days' worth of capture time. We were able to do some dynamic compression, so the capture tool would write things out to TempFS. We then look to see how busy we are. If we're busy, we'll just write it out to disk. If we're not very busy, we'll compress it a whole lot. And there were a few intermediate stages where you compress it a little bit if you weren't very busy. 2004, we have some new switches that we're working with for doing this sort of thing. Unfortunately, they have smaller buffers. Turned out it was just a different vendor. The net effect was is that capture now overrun the switch buffers. So you actually looked at the traffic and you went, yeah, 1 gigabit is going to be fine. But they had bursts that were fast enough that you got packet drops on the switch. So our first attempt was, okay, we'll just get a 10 gigabit network card. We plug it in. We use our previous tool. And we discover all we managed to do was move where we drop packets from the switch over to the host. So we ended up actually going in and hacking the kernel and modifying the driver so that we would actually capture packets directly out of the driver and they never went up the IP stack. This led to the very amusing discovery that our capture system could capture packets faster out to disk than the Linux kernel could drop them. In 2007, we wanted to take some more traces, and now we're at least getting fairly recent. Unfortunately, time had gone forward and network rates had gone up by quite a bit. And more, unfortunately, than the rate at which we expected technology would have just naively progressed us. So we got ourselves a special capture card. These are people that make an FPGA that can capture small packets at line rate. We used that, and we took the dynamic compression that I talked about earlier. We integrated it all into a single application, which eliminated one of our copies. And at 5 gigabits a second, you can't afford to be doing very many copies. So did it work? Let's take a look at the 2007 set of data. On your x-axis, you have the quantile, which says, you know, 90% of the stuff is below here. This is your megabits per second. For people that like to think of this as a CDF, turn your head sideways. We have four curves on here. The bottom curve, we're going to take all of our data, we're going to divide it into 60-second intervals. We're going to see how many megabits per second we did in 60-second intervals. 10-second intervals is the blue line. 10-millisecond intervals is the green line. 1-millisecond intervals is the red line. As you can imagine, in our week-long traces, there are a lot of 1-millisecond intervals, and we actually do subsampling in order to make sure that we're not getting weird effects. The first thing you can see is the measured workload is quite bursty. 90% of the time, we're below 2 gigabits a second, but you see bursts out here, even 60-second bursts, that are above 5 gigabits per second. So this tells us that our capture tool, because about 60 seconds, we start running out of memory to buffer things, we can sustain 5 gigabits a second. And we can burst up to 7.5, and that's an artifact of we misconfigured the capture card. We should have been able to burst up to 10, and the paper discusses that some more. So this gives you an idea of exactly how well the tools can work. There is data on the 2003 tracing in the paper, which used the previous tool. So discussion on the capture. Please stop with the papers that say, I captured data, and I had packet drops. There's no reason to have that anymore, unless you're capturing at supercomputing sites where you're doing 100 gigabits a second. All right? We can do 10 gigabits a second, and almost all file system traffic is less than that. You do have a choice, and the choice is really based on your expected data rate and your available resources. If you're less than a gigabit a second, just download and use the LinDump tool. It'll work on anything. You're done. If you're getting a bit faster, and you have a kernel hacker around who can spend the time on it, go and implement Diver Dump. And it really is implement. You have to modify the driver for your thing. If you're above that, go off and purchase NDACE Dump, which is really purchase the card. Let's look at the next stage of this, conversion. First thing we have to figure out is how do we want to represent things. The answer is we want to put it in a relational data model, multiple tables. 30 years worth of database research can't be that wrong. We also want to have an efficient physical representation. Our solution to this was to use something we developed previously called Data Series, which is very, very efficient at storing and analyzing large streams of data. We wanted to do a very rapid trace conversion. It turns out this means you have to parallelize it, and unfortunately, parallelizing these sorts of things is actually a two-stage process that you have to pass over the data twice, but it does let you parallelize it. Finally, we want to do trace anonymization. Our solution to this was reversible encryption. And the reason for this was that we can actually take any of the things in there and turn it back into the original thing. This was important to us because we worked on the encrypted traces all of the time. But when we talked to the customer about issues we found, we needed to give them something more than random strings of hexadecimal to discuss. Analysis techniques. First challenge, you convert large data sets and you get, say, 50 billion rows. That's roughly the size of each of the 2007 data sets that we were analyzing. This did mean we had to write custom analyses in C++ so that they could run fast enough to get over this in a reasonable time. You get a fairly large amount of intermediate data as you're doing this. This means you actually want to do a streaming analysis. This keeps the memory usage down. You find that there are many ways of grouping the data, by host, by operation, by direction, etc. There was a technique known as data cube from the literature. Our contribution was to convert it to something that was a streaming data cube and was very, very efficient about how fast it got through things. The last piece, which you've actually already seen the use of this, is we have bursty non-normally distributed data. And that means that we actually want to use approximate quantiles, which gives us a way of reducing hundreds of billions of data points down to the graph that you showed, that I showed you earlier. For graphing and reporting, by the time you've gotten to this stage, you have a relatively moderate size of summary data, think millions of rows. We at this point just start storing an SQL database. It's fast enough at those sizes, and the flexibility of queries is quite nice. You get a whole bunch of possible graphs out of it. We have a tool which ties together the SQL database and GNUplot, and you can basically say, run a query, and it looks for columns named things like X and Y error, and will just generate it. So there's the example from the paper. The second thing I said we needed to do is we needed to collect a lot more traces. We've collected some. Let's take a look at them. So first thing we'll take a look at is the distribution of operation rate. So you got two curves on here. One of them is the operation rate at 1 hour intervals, and one of them is the operation rate at 1 second intervals. And you can see that down at the lower quantiles, your 1 hour rate is greater than your 1 second rate. This is your averaging effect for things. And at the 1 sec and at the high rates, you're going to get the exact reverse effect. This repeats the fact that the burstiness we were seeing in the network traffic is actually there in the operation traffic as well. And it validates our use of quantiles rather than summarizing this in a mean and standard deviation, which would tell us, we did about 30,000 operations per second. Unfortunately, plus or minus about 20,000, which tells you you really got nothing useful out of that. The second thing we want to look at is file sizes. So log scale this time on the x-axis. The big thing that you should be noticing is this line right here. The customer had done some testing. They set their NFS I/O size at 16K based on what they believed was optimal. That's the crossover point for two of our data sets. About 60 to 70% of the files in our traces that are accessed are less than 16K. These are tiny. 99% of them are less than about 3 megabytes. This is quite a bit different, and if we hadn't talked to them before taking the traces, we would have been surprised by this too. But this is actually a byproduct of the process that they use. You do have a moderately wide distribution in here. So let's take a look at how reads progress in a thing. And for this, we need to figure out how we're going to group them. So let me go over this. This is actually previous work. We didn't invent this. We're going to take, for each file, we're going to look at it, and this is sort of time going over there. You got a bunch of read operations that occur. We're going to look at them. We're going to look at the gap between the reads. So there's a gap that's less than 30 seconds. There's a gap that's bigger than 30 seconds. 30 seconds is a constant that was used in some of the prior work. We're going to take the groups, and we're going to divide them. So every time we see a 30-second gap, we're going to put a cut in. That's the boundary between them. So there you got group 1, and there you've got group 2. In this example, group 1 has 4 reads in it. Group 2 has 1 read in it. Continue this exercise for all the time and all of the accesses on this file. Continue it for all of the different files that you have. Let's take a look at what happens when we analyze our data like this. Again, you got your quantiles here. This is your number of reads. So one is there, four is somewhere around there. Two data sets, same two we've been looking at before. More than 70% of all IOs occur all by their lonesome. No other accesses to that file for 30 seconds. Some relatively long runs. This is, to a large degree, a side effect of the many small files, but for those that have a really good memory, you'll remember that even in this trace, we didn't have 90% single thing files. So that actually shows you that even on larger files, we're still seeing isolated IOs. This tells you that if you want to do efficient prefetching for this workload, you can get a little bit out of sequential IO prefetching, but most of your prefetching is going to have to be cross file. So, in conclusion, our capture techniques, we should not be seeing any more packet loss out there. These techniques are completely general, so if you want to capture SIFS, if you want to capture iSCSI, they're completely applicable. If you know you could get away with just headers, you'll want to improve our techniques to capture that. We didn't bother to put that flag in. The conversion techniques are very NFS specific, so if you want to work with NFS traces, they're useful. You're working with something else, they're not. They do need improvement, and there's some discussion of that in the paper. The analysis techniques actually go back to being fully general. You can now work with data sets and queries that will generate hundreds of billions of data points, and in a sane amount of memory, which is to say a few hundred K, actually do statistics over that are meaningful. As a result of the efficiency, you can do this all on moderate hardware. I can actually do, with the exception of not quite being able to fit all the traces on my laptop, analyses on my laptop. And we did the calculations on single servers, which allowed us to parallelize across our data sets and figure out which ones we thought were the most interesting. For those people that are interested in new workloads, our workload is very different. It's very, very intense, which means we're in the good state where for a long time in the future, people will be still subsetting our data when they're using it in their analysis, rather than randomly speeding it up by a factor of 10, which distorts it. The second thing that's very different is our workload has a lot of incredibly small files, which will stress designs of systems in a very different way than they had been stressed before. If you want, you can go and read the paper. It's got a whole lot more detail on all of these techniques. It's got more discussion on when and how to use them. If you just want to apply the things, you go and download the tools and the traces, and you can come back to us and improve them. So, at this point, I will comment. There is a tracing boff tonight, 8:30 to 9:30. I encourage people that are interested in this to come and talk about it. The URLs there include all the locations for where you can get the software and the data sets. The IATA site doesn't actually yet have complete data sets because they don't have enough SIS space. I would hope that people will work with these traces, because my personal hope is that the academic community will do interesting analyses on this, and we will be able to go back to the customer and say, see, you got a benefit out of putting your traces out there. And then we'll be able to go to additional people and say, look, these people are getting a big benefit about having their traces out there. Maybe you should let us trace your system and put them out there too. Questions?
We do have time for a few questions.
Brent Welch, Panassas. Were you able to figure out the working set of the textures and models? Because animation's cool. You have a lot of shared stuff that all the render farm is going to share, and then you got a bunch of 1 megabyte image files or three megabyte image files.
Actually, even the image files tend to get shared because they get reread a little bit, but not a lot. We did very early analysis that convinced us it was small enough for our purposes. We did not do an extensive analysis on that. As I said, our analyses really just scratched the beginning of looking at the data sets.
And then one quick follow-on. Yeah. I'll And 70,000 ops a second, that's per filer?
That was aggregate across the workload. There is a wide variety between the different filers. Some of them are very busy, and some of them are very idle. They hold archival stuff from previous movies, so you will see occasional uses of them, but you've got filers that are doing, you know, an operation a second.
I've seen much higher bursts in animation environments than only 70,000 ops a sec.
So have we. This depends on where you, I didn't talk about exactly where we captured, but all of the traces that I was talking about in the talk were actually captured in front of a subset of the clients, because what we wanted to see was all of the workload coming out of the clients. We also have some traces that are in front of servers, and in those cases, you only see traffic for that server, but you see many more clients accessing it.
Interesting. Okay.
Brent Callahan, Apple. You said you were looking at redir results. Were you doing packet reassembly to kind of put those results back together?
No, this was, as I said, there were some flaws in our converter, and that was unfortunately one of them, was we didn't actually do enough packet reassembly. The paper also talks about, it turns out you can get misaligned things in your TCP packets, and if a request wasn't aligned at the beginning, we'll actually miss it. We learned this very late, actually after the paper was accepted. It turns out to have a small but biasing effect on writes. We underestimate the number of writes. The replies. The requests you actually see, you just don't see the replies. So you get half of the operation. The problem was it was a small effect. So it was in the, you know, less than 1% type of a thing, aggregate over the entire trace, so it didn't stand out.
Okay, thanks.